Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Oh, my gosh. I'm back inside the wee four walls of the Dump Studio this morning after enjoying the open-air gazebo at the Tunbridge World's Fair yesterday. What a great time getting back to the fair. I want to thank everyone at the Tunbridge World's Fair, the staff there, for all of their help. And a reminder to all of you listeners that the fair continues through Sunday. This morning, we're going to walk for the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. We're going to dance with the Vermont Dance Alliance. And we'll read some food labels, get a better understanding of them. And as always, on a Friday, we'll hear from national correspondent Bob Ney at 10 o'clock. But first, we start out skiing. Earlier this week, I had the folks from the Rutland Sculpture Walk on the show. And as I was researching the walk, I was taken by one of the people who's commemorated with a marble sculpture, Andrea Mead Lawrence. We know the names of many of the state's great skiers present day, and I wanted to know more about Andrea. When I reached out to Carl Acker and told him what I was calling about, his response was, "I'm just the person." So Carl joins us now to share Andrea Mead Lawrence's story. Carl, thanks so much for being on the show this morning.
Morning, Rick. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're welcome. And listeners, to ask Carl about Andrea Mead Lawrence or to share a story of your own about her, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Carl, where did Andrea Mead grow up and where'd she spend her early days skiing?
She grew up, was born and grew up right here in Rutland, Vermont. And her parents, who were the founders of Pico Peak Ski Area back in the 30s, that's where she grew up. And she was learned how to ski and learned how to race from my father, who had been invited to come from Switzerland in 37 to start a ski school. And so she grew up right here. She lived in Menden in a place called North Tower, which is a castle that her father had designed and had built.
A castle.
And it's quite unique. Unfortunately, you can't access it anymore. But as a kid, I used to go there. And so she's as native and local as you can find.
Yeah.
In Vermont.
So how old was she when your father came over and started to teach her to be a ski racer?
How old was she? I would say, I have to get my calculator out here. Very young, probably in adolescent years.
Okay. And what were her events that she participated in?
She participated in, at that time, slalom, giant slalom, and downhill. And those were the three events that they had back in those days.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to know, first of all, I don't know your age, but did you ever race with her, against her? Was that something you did as a kid?
I did race. We're probably 14, 15 years difference in our age. So no, I never did race against her.
All right. So, and we'll find out later that she was already, probably at the time you were born, on the international circuit. Let's hear about your father. First of all, you know, you said he was from Switzerland. His name was Carl Acker as well. So what brought him over to the U.S.?
Well, Andrea's parents, Brad and Janet Mead, who were at the time going to develop the ski area known as Pico, were avid skiers back in those days when skiing in the U.S. was pretty limited. Mm-hmm. And so they would go to Davos, Switzerland on ski trips, and they had this in the back of their mind that they wanted to start a ski school at their ski area. And they met my father, who was probably in his 20s at that point, and invited him to come to Pico and start a ski school, and which he did. And then subsequently, you know, they had Andrea and also her brother Peter, who followed my father around the mountain all the time and took instruction from him. And she obviously went on to fame and glory. And the legacy around this area is still very alive and well for both her and my dad, who my parents became the owners of Pico later on.
They purchased the mountain from the Meads, is that correct?
Well, they purchased it actually from Janet Mead, because Brad Mead had been killed in a boating accident not too long after they opened the mountain.
Go ahead.
No, that's okay.
Had your father competed internationally in skiing when he was living over in Switzerland?
I believe he did. I don't have actual proof, but I've heard things over the years that he was a slalom champion, and potentially during the war years when the Olympics were canceled, he potentially could have been there. I can only hope that was the case, but that didn't happen. So
yeah.
And he was already over here.
And in speaking with your father, what did he tell you about Andrea Mead Lawrence, and what did he think about her talent?
Well, to be honest with you, let's see, I was 3 years old when she won her gold medals.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, my father died when I was nine.
Oh, my.
So the verbal interaction at that age was probably pretty minimal.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was constantly working on the mountain, and so I don't have a definitive answer for that, unfortunately.
All right, but what have you heard about her style, her skiing, her personality through the years, and talking to other people?
Well, I had as an adult, I got to know her much better than when I was a child, because she had, after the 56 Olympics, she moved with her family to Colorado and then eventually to Mammoth, California. And she was quite often come back to Rutland to receive, let's say, a degree at Green Mountain College 1 year, to have a reunion at Pico around all the older people that knew her at the time. In whatever year it was, in the early 90s, when the Vermont Ski and Snowboard Museum opened, she was the first inductee into the Hall of Fame there, and actually donated one of her gold medals to the museum, which is, I believe, still on display to this day. And so her legacy and history is very strong. There are plenty of other things going on around the area. As you mentioned, the sculpture that is in Rutland. And, I mean, the list goes on and on of stuff. There's a structure at Pike Oak called the Andrea Mead Lawrence Building, which is right next to the Pike Oak Ski Club, which is joined with Vermont Adaptive, if you're familiar with that.
Yep.
And so the Andrea Mead Lawrence Building is a commemorative to her, and there's lots of wonderful pictures and artifacts in there that can be seen. And as we all know these days, you can pretty much look up anything on the Internet and get an answer. So,
yeah. Well, Carl,
I forgot. Go to the Internet.
Okay. Well, Carl, having known her, having gotten to know her later on, what were your impressions of Andrea Mead Lawrence?
Well, I've been thinking about this since the other day, and I would say drive and determination were just a couple of her attributes that, you know, vaulted her into the international and Olympic racing scene. And I remember when she gave her speech at the ski museum, she said, every time I would get in the starting gate, I would say to myself, grit your teeth, And to me, that meant time to buckle down and fight for it. And as a ski coach myself, I can fully appreciate what that means. So that always stuck in my mind. Grit your teeth. And if you ever saw, if you see pictures of her in a race course, 9 times out of 10, she is actually gritting her teeth, if you know what that means.
Yeah, bear down, you know, good. Get, yeah, now it's time to concentrate. Yeah, no kidding. You said you taught skiing, so did you do some ski racing of your own in your day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I grew up at Pico, ski racing at an early age, and continued until right out of college, and then started coaching at that point, and coached for a pretty solid 40 years, and have been retired for the past 10 or so, shall we say. There was another thing I was going to say about Andrea, and that she, like I said, she had so much drive and determination, and nothing was going to stop her. And the record she achieved, which is still stands today, if I can interject this at this point.
Please do.
She still, to this day, is the only U.S. woman to have won 2 gold medals in a Winter Olympics.
And that was 1952? Yeah.
In Oslo, Norway. And Michaela Schifrin had a shot at it in the last Olympics, but she had a first and a second. This year, it could be different, but Andrea still holds that distinction, and that's quite amazing for that many decades.
It really is. Carl, she was 15 at her first Olympics. I think they were both Olympics and World Championships back then in 1948. And I know we've had gymnasts at that age or in that age range in the past, but that seems awfully young for a ski racer, for these events at that level and at that time.
Most definitely. I mean, she was, you know, on a pretty steep climb up the world rankings and qualified for the Olympics. And I would have to say that would have been a tremendous learning experience, which, you know, paid off in 52 when she won 2 events.
Yeah, and then she was 19. Was that kind of her peak in international skiing, 1952?
Yeah, I think so. You know, she actually was starting to raise a family at that point, and she was having other things going on in her life. So from what I understand, by the time 56 Olympics came around, she was going to compete, but, you know, did not do quite as well, not even remotely as close. But, you know, was on to other things at that point, shall we say.
Well, I'm just going to point this out. So between the 1952 Olympics, when she won the 2 golds, and the 1956 Olympics, she had 3 children. And then in 56 in Italy, she didn't medal, but she did finish 4th in the giant slalom. Look at that, isn't that an incredible accomplishment?
It is. It is. In that day and age, or maybe in any age, it is. It is amazing.
And she still was only 23 at that point.
Some people are just peaking out at that point. So.
Right.
One of the, if I may, a recent story of her family and her about 3 falls ago before the COVID shut things down, the Vermont Ski and Snowboard Museum has an annual induction of nominated people into their Hall of Fame. And that year, 3 years ago, Brad and Janet Mead were inducted into the Hall of Fame. And as many of their family members that could attend, Andrea's brother Peter was there. He's probably in his late 80s or whatever. And so I got to meet a lot of, and a couple of her children were there.
Wow.
So I got to meet, you know, some people that I knew of all my life, and they knew of me, but, you know, we'd never, they lived out west, and, you know, we never really crossed paths because our lives were going in different directions. But I got to meet, you know, like I said, a lot of her relatives. And at the end of the ceremony, they were gathering the family members for a picture. And they invited me to join in into the picture. And afterwards, I looked at some of the older folks there, and I said, you know, if it wasn't for Brad and Janet Mead, none of us would be here. And some of them acknowledged that they understood what I meant. And one of the younger children said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, they brought my father over from Switzerland, so that's why I'm here. They had two children that are your grandparents, and that's why you're here. And they go, oh, I got it. But the older people, you know, that were around my generation, they understood it right away, even though they probably had never thought about it that way.
Yeah, wow. Thanks to the Meads for all they were able to do.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole history is just amazing.
Yeah. We really rally behind our Olympic athletes now. But was this a big deal in Vermont at the time, back in the 50s?
Oh, yes. There are pictures around of her and my father riding in a parade down in Rutland afterwards. And on the side of the car, it said, world's greatest skier and world's greatest instructor. And she was given the key to the city, I think, maybe for the second time. And, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, back then things were a little smaller. The community was a little tighter, and people, you know, that skied at Pico, I mean, it was a huge thing here.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen the sculpture in Rutland that was done of her a few years ago?
Oh, yes. Yes. That was the same day. They unveiled that the same day as they inducted Brad and Janet into the Hall of Fame that evening. And that was generously donated by John and Sue Casella.
Mm. Oh, it is a stunning sculpture.
It is.
Right? It's one of the most beautiful I've ever seen. Now, what do you know about...
Impressive.
Yeah, it is. What do you know about the mountain in California being named for her, first by Senator Barbara Boxer and then by President Obama?
Mm-hmm. Well, she, from what I understand, you know, was very involved in environmental activism out there, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And other than what I have to honestly say, I am not overly familiar with. I'm familiar with it, but I can't talk about it too in depth.
Okay. But suffice it, that's okay. Suffice it to say, it was first named by the state, and then nationally, federally, President Obama did the same. And so our Andrea Mead Lawrence from here in Rutland has a mountain in California named for her.
Yes.
And as you mentioned earlier, there's the lodge at Pico that was named for Andrea. Tell us about that building.
Well, it's situated right next to the Pico Ski Club, which is right next to the base of the now chairlift, which was initially a T-bar where she grew up skiing, and as did I and numerous other people. I forget what year they started building that, but the Pico Ski Education Foundation, in conjunction with Vermont Adaptive, joined forces to construct that building, which on the bottom floor houses the Vermont Adaptive program, and the upstairs floor is, you know, multifunction building, multifunction rooms where the Pico Ski Club uses it for their athletes and, you know, any other functions that might come along. So it's a beautifully built building. It sits right there at the base of B Slope, which is one of the primary racing trails at Pico, always has been and always will be. And you know, upon request, probably people could get a tour of it.
What would you think Andrea Mead Lawrence would think about these honors, the lodge there at Pico, the sculpture there in downtown Rutland?
Yeah, good question. She was always, you know, not bashful, talking about her accolades, but she was also very humble about it too, and, you know, appreciated, you know, all the accolades she got over the years. And, but she was always very forthcoming and, you know, giving her time. And again, like I said, she donated an Olympic gold medal to the Ski Museum. So, I think she would be, I hope she would be truly humbled, but extremely grateful. And, you know, I know her family members who are not actually from here, but obviously are very familiar with it, were the night of the Ski Museum, were like, you know, very, very impressed and very happy that all these acknowledgments were being made and adding to the history.
Yeah. Andrea Mead Lawrence, one of the great Vermont skiers, and it's been a real treat getting to hear about her life and exploits. Carl Acker, thank you so much for sharing her story, keeping her story alive with us this morning.
The legacy goes on.
Yes, it does.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Take care, Carl. All right, let's hit the news, and then we'll be back to learn about a virtual opportunity you have to help the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation this weekend. And tonight on WDEV, the Sox are back from out west. They're at Fenway, take on the woeful O's. Our coverage begins at 6:10. The game begins at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. My next guest reached out to me a couple weeks ago and said she wanted to be on the show. Sid Buley is a UVM student, and she wants to let us know about an event going on this weekend to benefit the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. It's called Great Strides, and all of us can participate. It's a virtual event. Sid is with me now. Sid, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Now, listeners, if you've got questions for Sid about cystic fibrosis or about this weekend's Great Strides event, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sid, I'm embarrassed to say, I had to look it up myself with cystic fibrosis. Even though I've heard about it for decades, I'm embarrassed to say, I didn't really know what it was. So can you explain what cystic fibrosis is?
Yeah, cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease, and it affects the lungs and digestive system of patients. It's considered a life-threatening disease, not necessarily terminal, but it requires years of treatment, both physical therapy and different medications that can modify the way the proteins go in the cells. In not medical speaking, it just means basically you cough a lot and the mucus in your lungs is a bit gross.
And you have cystic fibrosis?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you were born with it. It's a genetic disease. When did you realize, when did you know that you had cystic fibrosis?
Yeah, I was diagnosed at 3 months old. I was very underweight as a little infant and very sick, and once I got diagnosed and started being treated, it just turned my life around completely. So I've had it my whole life. I'm 22 now, and at this point, it just feels like an everyday usual occurrence for me.
And that usual occurrence is what? How is it having cystic fibrosis?
Yeah, I take meds every time I eat food because my body doesn't digest fat. I have to do physical therapy every day for about 2 hours a day when I'm healthy, sometimes up to 5 hours if I'm sick, and a lot of routine maintenance IV therapies when my lungs kind of flare up and get really different infections going on. So,
and it's fairly rare. There's no known cure. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So what is available to help those with cystic fibrosis?
Well, the most recent and biggest change has been this medication called Trikafta, which Vertex produced. And part of why we have this fundraiser is because the money from it goes to producing medications. What that medication does is it works on the cellular level to almost fix the disease. It doesn't cure it, but it makes the symptoms a lot better. On top of that, you have routine IV therapies, daily medications, daily physical therapy, and just really being on top of your health.
And has it prevented you, does it prevent you from participating in any activities?
It has, but normally it did not. So when I was younger and my lungs were a lot better, I could keep up just fine. I was a three-season athlete, and I loved it. By the time I got to late high school, my disease had progressed a little bit more, and it was a bit harder for me to run and keep up in physical sports. But since taking this new medication, Trikafta, 2 years ago, I'm back to functioning right along with all my friends. I can keep up. I can go for runs. I can play sports. It's amazing. And I really miss that, like, three-year gap in my life where it was really difficult to do that.
You mentioned three-season sport. What sports did you participate in? Were you a fencer?
I was a fencer, yes. And I used to ski race, play volleyball, and play a bit of softball, too.
No kidding. Ski race. We just talked about one of Vermont's great ski racers, Andrea Mead Lawrence. When you were a fencer, épée or saber?
Épée.
All right. I'm showing off everything I know about fencing right there. So what has it been like for you as a patient with CF?
It's been very interesting. I was very comfortable with being in the hospital at a young age because I was used to having to go in every couple months either for checkups or if I was sick for, like, inpatient IV medications. And it was nice because I learned to appreciate the nurses and the healthcare workers around me a lot because sometimes you're stuck in the hospital for up to a week or longer with CF just to get the treatments you need. So it definitely taught me that hospitals weren't scary for me. Mm-hmm. And it made me be really responsible for my health at a young age.
Well, that's very interesting. You recently moved to Vermont. Am I right about that a few years ago?
Yeah, I am a UVM student. And then my family moved up here in 2019 because they just visited me a bit and love Vermont. So mm-hmm. I have loved being here.
So I'm guessing that most doctors or specialists know how to treat or care for CF, but does it take some learning to have a new doctor, have new specialists? You came from where? Jersey or New York?
I came from New York. Mm-hmm. Growing up, I was treated at Yale Pediatrician's Hospital with their CF clinic. Here, I'm seen at UVM, which is great, and they have a whole specific division in pulmonology for CF care. But when I go to different doctors that are not specializing in pulmonary, it's a little bit difficult because most people have kind of heard of CF once or twice or in maybe like a high school bio class. So it is hard to just catch people up on all the medications, how careful I need to be when it comes into procedures or checkups that have nothing to do with my lungs.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know. I also read up about CF, about the life expectancy for those with cystic fibrosis. And it's kind of a good news, bad news situation. Can you tell us about that, the life expectancy and how that's changed?
Yeah. So growing up my whole life, life expectancy was around 40 years old. Now, though, that has drastically shifted in the past 2-3 years with all the medications that have come out, where even though the median average is still, I think, around 44, 45, that's really not representative of where we're going with all the medications we have, because the earlier you can start these medications, the longer you'll be. And at this mm-hmm. point, it's pretty much a good stance where if you have CF, you're most likely going to live just as long as anyone else, barring any extenuating circumstances.
That makes me feel much better learning that. Now, let's discuss Great Strides. What's the event and how do people participate?
So normally, Great Strides is held at Oakledge Park in Burlington, and it's a fundraiser and walk and a bit of a cookout all at once for people with CF, their families, their friends, just to come get together and celebrate, as well as raise money for the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. This year with COVID, we have to be virtual, so instead of walking at Oakledge, we're encouraging people to get out, be active, do all of that this weekend with the people they love, whether it's a hike, a bike ride, or just working out in your house. It doesn't really matter, but just doing something you like this weekend.
All right. And do you know where people go to sign up, to register, to take part?
Yeah. So you can sign up through the website, which is cff.org/greatstrides. And if you don't want to sign up, but you still want to help out, that same link, you can also donate to teams that are already registered.
And how much does the local foundation hope to raise this weekend?
I believe we are trying to raise $16,000. However, we will take anything. Above or below, we are happy.
All right. And you mentioned it before, but tell us again what the funding is actually used for that you'll raise during Great Strides this weekend.
Yeah, the CF Foundation actually funds most research for medications for cystic fibrosis, but that money also goes to patient support, so helping patients who may not be able to afford their medications or their hospital visits, as well as patient support groups where they can meet each other. One thing about CF that's really unique is that CF patients can't be physically together. COVID restrictions with distancing and masking is what we've always had to do around each other. So it's a nice way to get families and patients the support networks that they can meet each other and have each other around.
Oh, so you're an old hat at wearing the mask, which I should tell everybody, Sid is wearing one here in the studio with us. So this is nothing new for you.
Yeah, no. Sadly, this is definitely a bit easier transition for me into COVID than most.
All right. Sid, how does the funding affect or benefit like you, the person who's sitting across from me who has cystic fibrosis?
I would say the biggest way that funding has benefited me is mainly medication. I've been on numerous meds throughout my life. I'm currently on at least 15 medications, and most of them, this production, came from funding through donations like this. So,
and those 15 meds, do they affect you in any way? I mean, are there side effects that sometimes you're tired or you know, just makes it a little more difficult?
So the meds I'm on currently, they do not have side effects for me, which is fantastic, but that's definitely a trial and error bit to figure out which ones don't make you feel pretty gross. So I have had meds in the past that I've had to take that are, you know, maybe make me get hives or stuff like that I just have to figure out what works and what doesn't.
Yeah. As much as the money is important that you're raising this weekend, do you feel that raising awareness about cystic fibrosis is also vital, kind of your mission?
Yeah, absolutely. I think whether it's for me or for anyone else, it's a great tool to be able to talk about it and share patient experiences in a disease that doesn't affect too many people. And it's really a serious disease for the patients who have it, but it's also not, you know, the definite label of who I am.
Right.
So I love getting to come on and speak about this and share a little bit of knowledge for other people. Even if they don't interact with CF past today, it's still a good thing to know.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, when you get to high school, when you get to college, a whole new set of friends, roommates, et cetera, and you have to explain, okay, here I am. I love this music. I love to do these things. And there's one more thing you should know about me. And like you said, this doesn't define you, but it is something you have to make people aware about who you're going to be around. So what's the reaction, you know, of peers your own age when you tell them about cystic fibrosis?
Yeah, normally the reaction is at first like, okay, cool, not really understanding until around when I start to get sick and I start missing school or I need to spend more time at home to take care of myself. With COVID, this all entirely changed because I am in college and I live with roommates. So we had to have a discussion where, you know, we're in one of the lower risk demographics at the start, but I had to go, I need to go into full lockdown protection. That means, you know, don't go to parties, don't go to bars, which you shouldn't really be doing in COVID anyways, but it's just higher risk for me. So I love my roommates and my friends who have protected me and gone through that with me. But it definitely was a harder conversation because when we all lived together, we didn't sign up for COVID. No one did.
Right.
So it was a complicated conversation to have that now become a factor.
Well, you've talked about, you know, having to wear the mask generally. Now it's even more important, more a routine for you during COVID. So, you know, how difficult has it been, can you stay on campus? Are you working from home? Are you doing remote schooling? What are you doing as a student at UVM?
Last fall, I did remote school and lived with my family. In the spring, I took the semester off. I would have graduated last spring, but I didn't want to do all of my last semester online. This fall, I'm back on campus. I'm in classes because UVM has all students vaccinated and mask requirements, which is fantastic. So if they didn't, other students like me who are higher risk wouldn't have been able to go in.
All right. And so you are studying film, is that correct?
Yes.
Tell us about your major, what you want to do.
I love my major. I love film, and we mainly do film theory at UVM, so it ties into a lot of media production, newspaper stuff, all of it. And I love the reporting aspect in documentary film.
And I have snuck online to YouTube, and I think I did see a few Sid Buley productions. Am I right about that?
Yes. Those would mainly have been for class as projects that we do, but while some of them are a little weird and out there, they're very fun, and I've enjoyed with all the people that I've worked with at school.
All right. I want you to tell people about one in particular, which was very fun, and it was a game show to select the president of the United States, and I think you were elected president. Am I right? Was that you? No?
I believe so.
Yeah. All right. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was fun. That was a project where we were given like a 1 week deadline. It was four students and we had to come up with a whole idea of kind of not a serious political, but a funny little political bit. So we did this on a game show to elect the president, which was a little bit of political commentary in the U.S. and also just a fun way to look at all of this without having to get too intense on any side. It was really fun to shoot. My group absolutely procrastinated it, so we did it the day before it was due. It was stressful, but very fun.
The president was, I think it was set in Tacoma, Washington. The president was elected by the applause of the crowd, which was about 10 people. Hey, why not? The character that Sid played did indeed win. So what do you hope to do with your degree? You graduate in just a few months.
Yeah. At the moment, it's a little crazy, but ideally, I would love to do media production for television and film. Mm-hmm. So being on the side where you either advertise what's coming out or you help pitch different ideas for what a show or movie would be.
Now, you've done these short films. Any desire, any goal to do a feature-length film sometime in your life?
Yeah, I would love to. At the moment, I want to kind of hit the ground running to learn a bit more before I want to go off on my own and do that completely, just because I like having deadlines. I like having a whole group aspect, but absolutely would love to do a feature film at some point.
All right. So since you're a film major, I've got to ask, favorite movie?
Favorite movie is Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, nice.
Not because of how wonderfully cinematic it is, but that is by far my favorite movie.
Okay. How about favorite director?
Lately, it's been Martin Scorsese, which I know everyone says, but
right.
I do love it, yeah.
All right. And how about favorite actor or actress?
Ooh, that one is hard. Honestly, at the moment, I don't have a favorite actor or actress.
Well, seeing the Sid Buley films, I'd have to say Sid Buley is right up there right now. All right.
Yeah.
Let's make sure people know again about the event that's going on. It's called Great Strides. So it benefits the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. Tell us about where people go, how they participate, what they do, all those things.
Yeah. So to sign up or donate, if you would like either, would be cff.org/greatstrides. You can register and make a team to fundraise for this weekend, then get out, do something active over the weekend. Since the walk is virtual, pick any activity you like and just participate. If you'd like to donate, you can select a team through that same site and donate money to any existing team.
All right. And you've mentioned in your email to me that you wanted to let people know about the people of CFF, the people who support those with cystic fibrosis. So tell us, what it's been like, the care you've gotten, and who you'd like to thank.
It has been an absolutely amazing journey to get to where I am today, especially through the people who donate, who are my healthcare providers, who support me and other patients. My doctor that I've had from 3 months old to then 20 years old, she watched me grow up and was with me every step of the way. And I now thank my new team of doctors as well, because they've kept me healthy and able to be in school and live a life outside of just CF. So donations really matter, because they provide the medications and the treatments that we need to be able to do things outside of the hospital.
All right. One more thing, because it's very local, you have been doing some writing for the Waterbury Roundabout, so I'd love to hear about that experience.
Yes, I love it. I started working there about 2 years ago on an internship, and then now I just write freelance in my free time a bit, which I love. And it's been an amazing way to jump into the Waterbury community. As I had said earlier, I moved here in 2019, and I really got here fully during COVID. So it was a great way to jump in and get to learn everything about this area and meet a lot of people.
Sid Buley is a senior, a film studies senior at UVM, getting ready to graduate in December. To learn more about cystic fibrosis, and this weekend's Great Strides event, give us the website again, Sid.
Yep. Please visit cff.org/greatstrides.
All right, Sid, so glad you reached out to talk about this with me this morning. It was a great education for me, and best success this weekend with the Great Strides event.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. We've got a top of the hour CBS News up next. Then we'll be back to hear what's going on around the world and the country from national correspondent Bob Ney. And coming up this afternoon at 1 o'clock, it's Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. National correspondent Bob Ney joins us now, and we're going to get an update on what's happening in the world. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Great to have you back, Bob.
Yes, sir.
Why don't you run through the COVID numbers for us?
Yeah, you always begin with that, and I think it's a great thing to talk about. It's not a nice topic, but we need to have information on it, so I always appreciated that. The total deaths in the United States are 666,969, but when we look at a few things that are going on and breaking it down, 1 in 500 Americans have died from COVID. A majority of the deaths are above, you know, certain ages and into, you know, the 70s and 80-year-old and above categories. Now, what is something I think to note, Rick, is that, you know, the cases are falling a bit, but the deaths are rising. And so it's dealing with hospital beds now and, you know, the ability to take care of people because, again, cases are just beginning, the good news, to fall, but the deaths are rising.
Yeah, boy, that is a staggering number. 1 in 500 Americans have died from COVID. You hear news reports about Idaho, and they have to make decisions of who gets a hospital bed, giving it to those they think are more likely to survive. These are difficult things to hear. We have a vaccine. You just wish that more people would take advantage of that.
Yes, and then there's the kind of the, you know, debate about the booster shot, and it was broken down today in some language I saw from some physicians, which is basically, you know, it's not been, quote, approved yet, but if you're going to get it, you need to get it 8 months after your last two vaccines. That seems to be the one piece of accurate information that's beginning to come out there.
All right. And what is going on with the Biden vaccine mandate? Is this something we're going to have to pay attention to? How are people reacting to it?
Well, big business, the big business leaders, the roundtables, have embraced what the president's doing. Right, you know, right off the bat, they embraced it. Some of the individual state business groups haven't. For example, Texas is arguing against it, you know, and some of the maybe I would say more conservative states on this issue. But the business roundtable people have said okay. But also, I think if you look at this, you know, you've got this different type of decision all over the country. Your school, one of yours is different than another, or, you know, different than Ohio, et cetera, because of the way, you know, we function. And in the business community, too, there are certain mandates. Some of the hospitals in West Virginia, for example, I called, and some of the hospitals are requiring that you get it or you resign. Some of the people there that aren't going to get it, some of the healthcare professionals are saying, fire me. So eventually, beyond, you know, what the president is saying, mandating 100 or more employees you have to, you know, to make that decision to get it, beyond that, you're probably going to see some lawsuits here and there. Eventually, they're going to pop up over this, not just the health issue of what's best for people, but also lawsuits.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about something called the AUKUS agreement?
Yes.
What is this all about?
You know, when I was asked about Joe Biden when he was running for president, the one thing that stuck in my mind, because I, you know, knew Joe Biden as a U.S. senator, was his mastering of foreign policy. In the Senate, he was considered, you know, one of the real people, you know, ahead on foreign policy. It's kind of interesting, though, as president, he's become a little bit different than the style as Senator Biden. With Senator Biden, a little bit more pragmatic and basically kind of predictable. As president, it's a little different. And yesterday kind of took the European Union by shock, especially France and China, by the way. He has an agreement, and it's called the AUKUS agreement. He's made a deal with Australia. They're going to be privy to some of our nuclear sub-secrets, which is okay. It's Australia. And basically, we're going to be providing them the ability, wherewithal, and equipment to be able to produce these nuclear subs. Who's angry at that? China. They're furious. Why are they angry? Because this puts Australia in a decision-making. They've been kind of, we're with China and we're with the United States. Now they're with the United States, and they're going to be part of the, you know, policing, I guess you could call it, of the seas. And that China doesn't like. On the other hand, too, France lost a $90 billion contract when this was announced. So they are not happy with us over money. So the president kind of, I guess, did a surprise move that's not the usual, you know, pragmatic Senator Biden.
And we should say, Bob, that China has taken steps over the last year in a negative way towards Australia. I think they've cut off certain things, yes, that are being imported. So those relations have been strained there. It's probably a good time, politically speaking, to step forward and make this pact with Australia.
Oh, I think so. The president saw a path. He took it. And again, the European Union, they're a bit upset. France is the more, you know, out front upset because, again, $90 billion contract, so they're not happy about that. But for the good of the cause, I think what the president's doing and getting Australia on our side totally is a good thing.
Yeah. You or I might be able to get by without that $90 billion, but France, it might be
right.
A little difficult.
Yeah.
And the timing was a little odd as well for someone like Joe Biden to drop this because of what the European Union was about to do.
Well, yes, that's true, too. By the way, I should mention, I failed to mention this, the United Kingdom's in this. They're in the AUKUS partnership, too. So I did want to mention that when you talk about Europe, you know, England, is they're in there. But the French officials were set to host a gala in Washington to celebrate the United States alliance and mark 240 years, of a crucial shared victory, the United States Revolutionary War, and the event's canceled.
Oof, yeah, no gala. All right, I'll take the
touchback. That one's out.
Yeah.
No gala.
Yeah. So how does Joe Biden keep the peace with Europe now?
Well, I think there's other fish to fry. Now, with France, of course, again, it's economic, but I think with the European Union, NATO, you know, the position he's taken on that, the president has embraced the climate change accord, you know, the Paris Accord, which Trump canceled us out of it. That's very important to Europe. So, again, you know, we're not in a divorce with the European Union, just a little stumbling block, a temporary tiny little separation. But there's other fish to fry and other big issues, and they will pay attention to that. This won't be the end for the European Union with us.
One domestic fish to fry is with the most powerful man in Washington. That's not Joe Biden, but Senator Manchin of West Virginia. How are those two dancing right now?
Well, Senator Manchin has been courted by many people, and he said no to the $3.5 trillion. He said it to his leader, Chuck Schumer. I don't think they believed it. And then he went on the Sunday talk shows 2 weeks ago, and he said no again, that he would do maybe $1.5 trillion, but he wouldn't do $3.5 trillion. So that makes a big difference, not just money, but how you plug new policies into that. And then, of course, the House is struggling because they want the $3.5 trillion. So they did the big deal. And, you know, I've sat face-to-face with a couple of presidents. It is not easy, believe me, to just say no to a president. You want to kind of find a compromise, you know. So President Biden called Senator Manchin over, Democrat from West Virginia, and face-to-face. And Senator Manchin said, nope, we're not going to do, you know, $3.5 trillion if you're asking me that. And so that's it. I mean, there's no more wiggle room. And what I'm not understanding here, having been in politics for, you know, a couple of decades, if you need 50 votes to pass $3.5 trillion and you have 49 with no one budging, guess what? You've got to sit down, if you're the Democratic leader, Schumer, with Senator Manchin and say, okay, where are we at?
Right.
But they tried with the president, and it just didn't work.
Wow. With Joe Manchin, no means no. All right. One more topic to discuss, and that is the rally coming up tomorrow in Washington, D.C.
Well, this is going to be looked at security-wise. They're not going to have a redo of what happened, you know, January the 6th. So National Guard's already been alerted. They will take all means necessary if the same type of thing happens of people trying to breach the Capitol. But on a bigger picture, you know, they're billing this as the, you know, kind of supporting the, what do I call it, the selfie picture takers. You know, they weren't in there destroying the Capitol. And people that were out there protesting, that's one thing. When they breached the Capitol, that becomes a different scenario. So this is really being billed as, you know, let's defend. It's kind of let me put it this way. It's a rewrite of history that, you know, while really nothing bad happened that day, let's defend, you know, the people that went to the Capitol. And I'm sorry, Rick, I just don't get this one. There is a separation between the people who protested for whatever cause they had, you know, right, of fraud and election fraud at the Capitol. And then there's the people that went inside and did different things that were not tourist-oriented or protest-oriented. It was, you know, insurrection. It was violent. And so they're kind of building this the same way. I don't think, I could be totally wrong, I would not imagine they would want to try to repeat what happened on the 6th of breaching the Capitol.
Right. It doesn't behoove their cause.
Would not at all.
Right. And so if they want to have establish any credibility that, you know, what happened on January 6th wasn't that bad, they will behave this weekend in Washington, D.C., but all eyes will be on that. Bob, let's hope next week we're not talking about that. It just will an event that comes and goes. 7 Days has its annual performing arts issue out this week, and that gives us an opportunity to speak with Elizabeth Saylor for the first time. She's the co-editor of the Arts and Culture section. Elizabeth, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hello, Rick. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. Now, Elizabeth, we're going to talk about your article from this week's 7 Days. It's about the Vermont Dance Alliance. So first of all, what is the Vermont Dance Alliance?
The Vermont Dance Alliance is a network of dancers, supporters, sponsors, other professionals who work in the field of performance. And it's basically designed to help people connect with each other, to support the ecosystem of dance in Vermont.
When did they get started, and how many members does it have? Is it all around the state? Where are they?
Sure. It is statewide. They began in June of 2016 and now have about 150 members. It supports all different kinds of dance, those who want to perform, you know, modern or tap or jazz, as well as people who just enjoy dancing socially, like doing tango or swing. It offers a number of programs that help performing artists and also bring really high-quality events to communities around the state.
Well, what kind of performances or events does the VDA put on every year?
They do four annual events. One is called Traces. It's an outdoor dance festival. It first started in Burlington, like around the waterfront. People might have seen dancers doing things downtown and then making their way down to the waterfront. Last year, or this year for the first time, it spread to three different communities. I believe it was Montpelier, Burlington, and Middlebury. And dancers are outside, and there's a guide that takes the audience from one dance event to another, all sort of weaving through the cities. That's Traces. The second one is a member retreat, where all the members can get together to talk about dance, to make connections with each other, to explore possible performances or activities or workshops. The third event that VDA hosts every year is a symposium, in which there are a number of speakers talking about topics important to the dance community. And then the final event is a gala show where people who've been working on performance events or performances gather together and put on a full-length show of really highly produced dance performances with lighting and costumes and everything. So those are the four events that VDA hosts every year. Plus, they basically support as many dancers as come to them with help with lighting or with funding or whatever they might need to put on their own shows.
How was the organization, or was it, impacted by the pandemic?
Yeah, at first it was quite a shock. There were many, many events, classes, and workshops and performances planned that had to be canceled. And so quickly the VDA gathered their members to talk about what they could do, how they could continue to support the dance community. So they went online, like so many creative artists. They went online and started offering classes and workshops and other events that basically drew attention not only from Vermonters interested in dance, but also from people in New England and across the country. I mean, they had people attending these workshops and classes from as far away as California. So in essence, the pandemic, there was a silver lining for VDA in that the online events allowed them to connect with people far, far beyond Vermont.
That's great to hear. I'd like to take a break from the VDA for just a moment. And since, Elizabeth, this is your first time that you've been on Vermont Viewpoint, I wonder if you'd care to tango. Actually, it's my way of giving you an opportunity of letting our listeners know about your dance background.
Sure. Thanks, Rick. let's tango anytime.
All right. You better lead.
Okay. And actually, oddly, as a woman, I can. I've been teaching tango for more than 10 years. I have a doctorate in dance from Temple University, and my dissertation was on the tango community in Philadelphia. People may or may not know that Argentine tango is a very improvisational and intimate and expressive dance. It's not necessarily what you see with the rose in the teeth and the snapping of heads. That's a different form of tango. But yeah, I've enjoyed dancing my whole life, all different kinds, swing and improvisation and modern. So I'm quite a fan of the VDA and what they're doing in the state. And I have to say I'm also really happy to see that there's a fair bit of dance coming to the venues around the state this year. With the Performing Arts Preview, we highlighted some of them. Do you want me to go into chatting about that, Rick?
Yeah, I'd love that. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Okay. Well, one person I'm really looking forward to seeing is tap dancer and actor Ayadel Cassell. She'll be at the Flynn in December, and she is a rising star in the tap world. She has a huge heart that I think you can palpably sense when she's on stage. She's very creative. She brings her African, her Afro-American and her Latin American roots to stage, to her work. So I think she's going to be fantastic. There also is some ballet coming, some other dance forms coming soon. I think right now or relatively soon, there's even an Indian dance performance at the Hop.
Wow. And even if you aren't a dancer, these dance performances are absolutely wonderful to experience. I just love going to them. Back to the VDA, there's new leadership there, Elizabeth. Tell us about, first of all, their new executive director.
Right. The new executive director is Mary Chris DeBellina. She's a Montpelier resident. She moved to Vermont in 2015 and very soon found the VDA and found that it helped her with networking and finding new connections and new people to work with in Vermont as an artist, as a dance artist. She has a couple degrees in dance. She's the mother of four children under the age of 12. I think one of them might have just turned 12. So she's quite busy, and she'll be doing this work part-time. But she says she really, really loves to help make things happen, and she particularly loves spreadsheets. And that's going to come in really handy, because the crux of her position really is fundraising. It's to help make sure the VDA has money to support artists and programs. Another one of her goals, though, is to expand the reach of VDA to children and to seniors. She obviously loves dancing with her own kids and wants to see more kids and families have opportunities to get involved in dance. And she teaches dance for people with Parkinson's disease, at the Senior Center in Montpelier. So she'd like to expand VDA's offerings to more seniors as well.
Now, they've also had a new board president. That's Joy Madden. What can you tell us about Joy?
Yeah, Joy has been a collaborator and a participant and a volunteer in the VDA since the very beginning. She's an accomplished dance artist locally, and also worked in the Boston Dance Alliance before she came to Vermont. So she has experience that she's brought to her new position as board president, having seen the way things worked in a larger city. One thing she mentioned when she got here was that she was really impressed with the way the VDA started and all of the activity of the members and the board since it began. She's very passionate about dance in Vermont, and also very passionate about the fact that everybody can dance. If you have a body, you can dance, you can move, you can enjoy connecting to music or connecting to others or just to your own personal space through movement. So she really wants people to know that the VDA welcomes all different types of bodies and abilities.
Now, Elizabeth, you mentioned that Mary Chris DeBellina, the new executive director, loves spreadsheets, and it's important because of the fundraising that needs to be done for the VDA. What are the major expenses that the organization has in putting on performances?
Right. Well, a dance performance can actually be pretty pricey. You have the rehearsal space that the group needs to use again and again when they're designing, choreographing the piece, practicing the piece, getting together. Then when there's a performance, you have the performance space rental, as well as lighting and costumes and music and perhaps a director who's going to help pull it all together. Then there's all the publicity and ticketing and hosting people when the audience, when they come to the performance. So it's a really complex endeavor to actually put on a dance performance. And that's one thing that the VDA helps with. The VDA also can serve as a fiscal sponsor. Because the VDA is a nonprofit, it can kind of provide the financial management and administrative services behind other artists who want to put on their own shows in various places around the state, or who want to host events for the public, for example. So the VDA needs funding to keep their own website going and all the events that they offer, as well as helping to support other artists.
We've got about 30 seconds left. Knowing your background in dance, how robust is the dance community in the state of Vermont?
Well, it is growing, let's say, by leaps and bounds. it's been very active, I think, for a long time, but without the VDA as a kind of a central clearinghouse of information. People didn't know that where each other were. It's just, we were all spread out in the mountains and things. So I do think the VDA has helped spark not only connections but more activity in the dance world. And as someone who dances swing and tango, I have to say that there are quite a few social dance groups that are just as committed to keeping things going and building their base of people who enjoy it and who support them.
You can find Elizabeth's story in this week's edition of 7 Days or online at 7daysvt.com. Elizabeth Saylor, it was great having you on, and I look forward to having you back soon.
Thank you, Rick. My pleasure. Take care.
You too. All right, we're going to be back after a CBS News report, and then we're going to get a lesson on how to read food labels. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and finally today we get to talk about my favorite subject, food. Are you a label reader? How much do you pay attention to what's in your food, and how much do you understand what you're reading? Are the labeling requirements the same for all types of food? I'm really good at posing the questions, but have no idea what the answers are. So let's turn to our second guest named Sydney this morning. Sydney Bentz is a fellow at Vermont Law School and is part of a research team at VLS's Center for Agriculture and Food Systems that has developed a website to break down the law of food labels. She joins us now. Sydney, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a food label question for Sydney, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. All right, so you've put together this project at VLS, the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems, on food labeling. What is the purpose of the project?
So the purpose of the project, in short, is to give people another tool so they can better understand the choices they're making about food. The longer story is that we make, on average, over 200 food decisions every day, and even more when we're grocery shopping. And we have to rely on what the food labels are telling us. And so it's important, if you're trying to make food decisions with all the priorities you have to balance when you're grocery shopping, that you understand what's on the label. And even though labels legally have to be honest and not misleading, it doesn't mean that they're not confusing. So the purpose of the project is to make sure that people are actually buying what they think they're buying.
200 choices. That's quite a staggering number. I'm a little scared now to face another day. Who is in charge, Sydney, of making sure labels are accurate and honest?
So there's a lot of eyes on food labels that are making sure that everything on the label is supposed to be true. On the government side, you have the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. You also have the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and sometimes you even have the Federal Trade Commission. And then away from the agencies, you also have third-party certifiers, which are not related to the government, but those are private organizations and private groups that come up with standards, and you'll see logos on food sometimes that are, for example, B Corp is one. Another one would be Fair Trade Certified. And even beyond that, you have state legislators and courts who are making even more specific labeling laws.
Yeah, you know, when you're mentioning this, I think we did in Vermont on things like GMO, also on milk. So we do indeed have separate legislation in our states. What are some of the most commonly misunderstood label claims?
So one of the most misunderstood label claims, and the one that I was most surprised to find out, is the term non-dairy. So on food, when you see non-dairy, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's no milk in it. And my whole life, I was thinking that non-dairy meant there's no dairy in it. But really what it means is if there is a caseinate ingredient, which is a scientific way to say a milk protein, it has to be followed by a statement saying its source. So it might say, on a non-dairy creamer, it might say sodium caseinate made from a milk derivative. So it doesn't necessarily mean that there's no milk in it, which was just super surprising.
And those who can't have dairy in their diet, isn't that pretty dangerous?
Honestly, I don't know. I'm
okay.
Not a medical professional.
That's
I don't
right.
eat dairy, not from a health standpoint, but it was still very disappointing to find out that I've been relying on this claim, and it's not what I thought it was.
So you read that a little more closely. Is there anything that cannot be on a food label?
So generally speaking, you can't have anything on a food label that is false or misleading. If it's false or misleading, it's considered misbranded under a law called the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. But what is misleading is not always easy to figure out. There are a few things that the FDA or USDA have come out and said, no, this is just per se misleading. A good example is, again, on milk, if you see grade A. For most liquid milk that you're buying in the supermarket, the only grade there is grade A. And so the FDA has said you can't use a term like select grade because it implies that there's other grades or it's a higher standard than grade A.
So is there like a grade double A or a grade B in milk?
In fluid milk, no. In some cheeses and butters, there is.
All right. So no matter what, that grade A is almost like redundant. If we're buying milk on a shelf, it's going to be grade A. While we're on dairy products, are all 1%, 2% milks graded in the same manner?
So fluid milk, or the milk that you're buying in the carton, is controlled by the FDA. And when you see the 1% or 2% milk fat, that's pretty much pretty strictly regulated. So it's not that one is a higher quality than the other. It's more a statement of what ingredients are in it.
All right. And can a dairy say something like calcium builds strong bones? Is that all right to put on a label?
Usually things that have statements about healthiness are more strictly regulated and usually have to be approved by the FDA beforehand. And the FDA has a list of certain health claims that match up to certain foods and certain ingredients. And so things like calcium builds strong bones, it has to be approved beforehand, but it is regulated.
All right. That's some mild consolation there. What are some of the most recent trends in food marketing that we're seeing on labels, maybe like ethically sourced or sustainably harvested?
Right. So ethically sourced and sustainably harvested are two big ones. I think we're seeing more plant-based marketing and a lot of ethical statements like humanely raised.
Mm-hmm.
So for ethically sourced, there's no specific regulatory definition. And that's the same for sustainably harvested. So it means what the producer pretty much decides it means. Again, it can't be plainly false or misleading. So the producer can't just come up with some random definition. It still has to essentially mean ethically sourced or sustainably harvested. But as long as it's reasonable, it's probably legal. The other side to this is that there are third-party certifiers. These are private non-government organizations that have guidelines for what they consider to be sustainably harvested. So, for example, if you buy something that's Fair Trade certified, that's certified by Fair Trade USA. And they have guidelines based on the product for what they consider to be fair trade. And this considers things like safe working conditions and environmental protection. So you really have to look at the label and see, is it certified by a third-party certifier, or is it just a plain statement.
Mm. Self-certified is not a good thing, I take. All right. Is there a difference between organic food and natural food?
There is a huge difference. And this was another thing that when we were building out this project was just something we encountered over and over again, because people are willing to pay more money for organic food and people are willing to pay more money for natural food. But the reality is that organic food is pretty strictly regulated. It falls under multiple laws, the biggest which is the National Organics Program, which lays out exactly what can go in the soil. It even goes back before the food is grown. So several years before the food is grown, you have to make sure that you're complying with organic standards. There are a lot of details that go into these regulations, and the regulations even address whether it's 100% organic, whether you can have a percent number on it at all. So it's very specific. But natural doesn't have a specific regulatory definition. The FDA does have what they call a long-standing policy about how they interpret the word. And in short, they say it was not fundamentally changed. The food doesn't have anything that you wouldn't expect to be in it. So color additives, whether they're natural or artificial. And if the food label has the word natural on it, there should be a statement explaining how the producer has defined the term, for example, saying no artificial ingredients or minimally processed.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Jim calling from Barry. Hi, Jim. Go right ahead.
Hi, good morning. I just had a question that might help to clarify the grade A milk. When I was a kid, I used to have family in the Midwest that had grain farms, a lot of them, and they all milked 8 or 10 cows for grocery checks, they called it. And they would always say, well, we're not a real dairy farm. The guy down the street was a real dairy farm. They had like 100 cows. And the difference was they had to maintain lower standards in their milking barns and refrigeration and all that stuff than the real dairy farm. And the distinction was their milk only went to cheese. A real dairy farm's Class A milk or Grade A milk was able to be sold as fluid milk. In Vermont, I understand they're all grade A, even though a lot of it goes to cheese. And this thing called the blended milk price is from the Midwest, because they blend the Class A or the grade A and the grade B prices together to come up with a blended price for the East. I might have that completely wrong, but I'm just looking for clarification. Do I understand it correctly?
Thanks, Jim. Sydney, what do you know about that?
So, to me, that sounds mostly right. We're dealing with a couple different agencies when we're talking about dairy products. We're dealing with the FDA a lot of the time, but there's also USDA grading standards, and those are voluntary grading standards. The confusing thing with FDA milk is we're also dealing with something called the Grade A Pasteurized Milk Ordinance. And the FDA writes the milk ordinance, and then states adopt it. And as far as I know, all of the states have adopted it. And the milk ordinance is just hundreds of pages, and it addresses almost all dairy that the FDA has control over and sets very specific standards about refrigeration, pasteurization, storage, all of these things. And under the milk ordinance, that's how you're going to determine whether or not it's grade A, if it's not grade A, if there's exceptions to the grade A. But for most consumers, if you're looking at just the milk in the cooler, mm-hmm. you're only going to find grade A.
All right. Boy, the only thing more fun than than understanding milk pricing is understanding milk grading. Sydney, let's go through some of the things we see on labels. What does non-GMO mean?
So non-GMO is another one of these difficult terms where it depends on whether or not we're talking about non-GMO certified from a third-party certifier, or if we're talking non-GMO generally. If it comes from a certifier, you have to find which certifier it is, go to their website, and find out what their standards are. If it's not certified by some private organization, it gets even more difficult, because the USDA and FDA don't have regulatory definitions for the term non-GMO. both agencies have working definitions of genetic modification. So the USDA defines genetic modification as the production of heritable improvements in plants or animals, and that's not very easy to understand. The FDA's longstanding position has been even traditional plant breeding methods fall under genetic modification because you're changing the way that the plant either tastes or looks or things like that. So there's not a ton of clarity around what non-GMO means. The FDA does consider it to be mislabeling if the label implies that food without GMOs is in some way superior to those with a similar label. And one clear guideline is that the FDA considers 100% organic products to be non-GMO.
What is your interest in product labeling?
Can I list off a couple?
Please do. I'd love to hear that.
So I think my biggest interest in food labeling is the rise in what I call ethical consumerism. So I think the internet has empowered more people to look into supply chains and where their food comes from. And, you know, in the U.S., when we're voting with our dollar, as they like to say, I think that makes the decisions feel a little bit more important than they otherwise were. When we're talking about things like palm oil, for example, there's a lot of opinions about palm oil, the rise in plant-based eating, humanely raised meat, and things like that. We have a lot of ethical decisions going into this as well. And with, you know, these 200 food decisions we're making every day, and that's not even mentioning the other decisions that we're making, we can get decision fatigue. And I think sometimes that food marketing relies on this decision fatigue to market their product, to charge a surplus on the product. And so I'm interested in making sure consumers and myself are buying food that aligns with our ethical decision making.
Is there anything that really does, and I don't want you to call out specific brands, but certain things you see on a label that really does make your blood boil?
I mean, I can go back to the non-dairy thing because that one just irritates me. But I think one of the other things that made me real mad, and this was years ago, is I bought maple syrup thinking it was maple syrup because it came in the little beige jar. It was not maple syrup. It had maple flavoring in it. So I think we're seeing a lot of product packaging, even though if you read the label real intensely and get out your magnifying glass, you're going to find out that it is corn syrup that's flavored like maple. But another one that we're seeing, too, is meat products trying to break into the plant-based market by having a lot of green on their packaging, having the packaging look and feel similar to plant-based packaging, or even I saw at the grocery store the other day that there's now a turkey burger that's blended with plant-based products, so it's half and half. And so if you're trying to avoid meat, you might think that you're getting a veggie burger, but really you're getting a turkey burger.
That just has some veg in it. Oh, my gosh.
Right.
Sydney, how do you hope people are using the Labels Unwrapped website? That's labelsunwrapped.org.
So I think there's two different functions, and I hope people are using both. So we have these drop-down menus that you can look up a claim and get, you know, a short blurb about what it is. So I've used it on my phone a couple times already grocery shopping because even I don't remember all of these. So I pull up the website on my phone. Like, the one that I always forget is the difference between whole grain and whole wheat. And so I'll pull up the grains page on my phone and say, oh, I actually want whole wheat, or oh, I actually want whole grain. The other part of it is we develop issue briefs, which are a couple pages long, and they really go into the specifics and the details of novel food issues. So one of the recent ones we put out is the Consumer's Guide to Bioengineered Food Disclosures. And so this talks a lot about GMOs and a recent law that's passed called the National Bioengineered Food Disclosure Standard. So in a couple months in January, you might start seeing little logos on your food that say produced from bioengineered foods. And I'm not sure that people will know what that means. So we made a whole brief, it's a couple pages long, that goes into exactly what foods that's going to go on, what it means, and what it means about the quality of the food as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sydney, I think I've made 4 food decisions so far this particular day, so I have 196 to go, and I'm now at least armed with a little more information. Sydney Bentz is a fellow at Vermont Law School, part of the research team at VLS's Center for Agriculture and Food Systems that has developed the website to break down the law of food labels. The website is labelsunwrapped.org. Sydney, thanks for giving us a better understanding of what those labels are or aren't saying.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. You can listen to the past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The WDEV podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah's up next. I'm Rick Sangari. I'll meet you back here on Monday.